So on the first Thursday of Great Lent, I told you we need the old stories and the new. And on this fifth Thursday of Great Lent, just past, what did we review? We reviewed the old stories, all of the old stories in the Old Testament. Well, not quite all, but and a lot of the ones in the New Testament, all of those old stories, and also the new story. The story of St. Mary of Egypt, which is the story that we are about to talk about today and is given to us to reflect on today. And it's interesting to me because I just in the last couple of days I've been thinking quite a bit about story. I was just chatting with my daughter about this strange pastime that we do as human beings. We tell one another stories. And then I was just commenting on Substack and somebody about Watership Down, which is an amazing fantasy novel about rabbits. I like to characterize it as Lord of the Rings with rabbits instead of hobbits. Although he pointed out that it is actually maybe better characterized as Virgil's Aeneid with rabbits, which is excellent characterization. And he wanted me to comment on the mythology of the rabbits have in Watership Down. And so I've been thinking about that as well and thinking about how I think that's actually why I tend to think of Watership Down as Lord of the Rings with rabbits. Because that's also what we see in Lord of the Rings. What do we see? When they stop and they have a campfire and they're tired, what do? They ask for a song, a poem, a story. And that's precisely what the rabbits do in Watership Down. When they are tired and it's the end of the day and they're all just trying to settle down, they want a story. And so they tell various stories about their prince, like the original kind of rabbit prince, El Herrera, the prince of the thousand enemies, because rabbits have lots of enemies. and Lord Frith, the kind of sun god in their mythology, and each of the stories that they tell is kind of apropos to what the rabbits are going through at that stage in their quest. And you know, when you stop and think about it, this behavior that is, you know, and attributed to the rabbits, but you know, they're us, right? It's very human. It's what we do. It's been masked a little bit for us, I think, with technology. You know, that time when we would sit down at the dinner table and, you know, just tell one another stories, or just after getting up from the dinner table and tell one another stories of our day. You know, it was hijacked in my day by television. Because what would you do after dinner? You turn on the television. That's prime time viewing, right? But what are we doing even in that situation? That's not so much the case now, but still, we're receiving stories. We're listening to stories, and stories have always characterized what we do, how we as human beings make sense of this world in which we live. And it was interesting going downstairs and seeing my family around the table and hearing Mariska Sera regaling everybody with the story, the horror story of her stay in the emergency room at Mission Hospital. why do we tell these stories? Because we need to make sense of the world in which we live. And it's interesting also as the rabbits in Watership Down go through their various adventures, occasionally they'll start a story and say, no, wait, it's not a good time for that story. And then they go off and they tell a different story because it's a time for a different story. Another story, another kind of story is the story that we need, that they need right at that moment. And what the church gives us as a story right at this moment is the life of St. Mary of Egypt. St. Mary was, as she tells the story, and it's really interesting as you listen to the story, because of course, being illiterate people, we read these stories, right? And in this story, it's actually St. Mary of Egypt's story is framed within a couple of different framing stories. And it's interesting, the very beginning framing story is one that I think kind of sets the tone for us as Christians, as followers of Jesus Christ. One of the things that we care about in terms of our stories is that they are true. More than that, that they actually happened. And so St. Sophronius begins with, it is good to hide the secret of a king, but it is glorious to reveal and preach the works of God. And it's a quote from Tobit. And it's his justification for telling this story, which in his day is a new story. Like, this is something that happened in our generation, he said. And I let no one think that I have had the audacity to write untruth or doubt this great marvel. May I never lie about holy things. So right away, the way that this story is set up for us is this is a true story. And then we hear this story, not about St. Mary of Egypt, but about Zosima, who's this monk, he's a really good monk. He's managed to master all of the various ascetic labors that are a part of his monastic discipline. And so he goes in search of another place where he can learn more. And so he finds this monastery in the desert near Jerusalem and joins this monastery because he's heard these guys are like really, really ascetic laborers. They've got the tough disciplines. And he's also hoping to meet somebody in the desert who can teach him something he doesn't know already. And in this monastery, they have the custom at the beginning of Lent of going out into the desert. And they spend the entire time of Great Lent on their own in the desert, each according to his own discipline before God. And they don't ask any questions when they get back. How did you pass your time? This is their spiritual discipline. And as he's going out into the desert, he sees a figure fleeing away from him. And he calls out, because this is exactly what he wants. This is a desert dweller. The only people who live in the desert at this point are monks, people of God, who, you know, they've deliberately embraced this really difficult ascetic way of life. So he's sure this is somebody who can teach him something. And she tells him, throw me your cloak, please, Abba Zosima, because I don't have any clothes and I'm a woman. And so he throws his cloak, kind of a little freaked out to think that she knows his name. and in fact, his very first words to her are, why do you run from an old man and a sinner? Slave of the true God, wait for me. Whoever you are, in God's name, I tell you, for the love of God, for whose sake you are living in the desert. And she tells him to throw her his cloak. He does so. And then his first request of her is to ask her to bless him. And then they're actually both prostrate before one another. And only one word is heard between them, which is bless. And in this blessing war, Abba Zosima wins the first round because he gets her to bless him because he realizes, you know, this is a holy, where does the blessing of God come from? It comes from holiness. And so the first thing Mary of Egypt wants to know is, how's the world doing? This, I think, is hugely revelatory. Her very first question is, how are the Christian people living? And the kings, how is the church guided? And Zosima's response is, by your prayers, mother, Christ has granted lasting peace to all. And then he asks her to pray for him. So first request is to ask her to pray for him. And she's like, you're a priest. You're the ones who's supposed to be praying, but you know, as we must all be obedient, I will gladly do as you ask. And she turns to the east and starts praying, and you can't make out any words of what she's saying, but he's kind of bowing his head and listening to her prayers. And at length, he figures, Her prayers are very long. This is a monk. He is used to long prayers. And her prayers are very long. So he looks up and she's floating above the ground by about, like, what does it say? A cubit, a forearm's distance. Yeah, a cubit. So he's a cubit above the ground. And he's freaked out. Not unnaturally, right? Maybe this is an evil spirit. And she says, no, why do thoughts confuse you and tempt you as if I were a spirit? No, I am only a sinful woman. I'm no spirit, but earth and ashes and flesh alone. And she, with these words, she guards herself with the sign of the cross on her forehead, eyes, mouth, and breast, saying, may God defend us from the evil one. And then he knows she's not a spirit. She's not an evil spirit. She's actually a human being. And then his next question, which is the one actually I've been driving at. I keep thinking that it was his first question. No, it wasn't his first question. But his next question is, do not hide from your slave who you are and whence and how you came into this desert. Tell me everything so that the marvelous works of God may become known. A hidden wisdom and a secret treasure, what profit is there in them? Tell me all, I implore you, for not out of vanity or for self-display will you speak, but to reveal the truth to me, an unworthy sinner. And so he asks her to tell him her story. Not for her own sake, not for her own vanity, but to reveal the works of God. And this is actually something that's really important, I think, in terms of the stories that we tend to consume and to prefer, I think, as Christians. I don't think it's coincidental, as I've said before, that the classic ending to the Western fairy tale is, and they got married and lived happily ever after. Because we need stories that have happy endings. And if you contrast this, say, with the Greek myth, they almost never end happily. So this is actually a monumental change in Western civilization that I think has been brought about by Christianity. Because what, of course, is the end of our story? It's the marriage supper of the Lamb. And in this case, too, the story that Abba Zosima is asking St. Mary of Egypt to tell him, her story, he knows it has a happy ending. And this is important. Mary of Egypt tries to say, I don't really want to, a couple of times actually. I'm ashamed to speak to you of my disgraceful life. But as you have already seen my naked body, I will likewise lay bare before you my work, so that you may know with what shame and obscenity my soul is filled. I was not running away out of vanity, as you thought, for what have I to be proud of? I was the chosen vessel of the devil. But when I start my story, you will run from me as from a snake, for your ears will not be able to hear, bear the vileness of my actions. But I shall tell you all without hiding anything, only imploring you first of all to pray incessantly for me, so that I may find mercy in the day of judgment. And now we finally get to Mary of Egypt's story. And it's actually fairly short. She's 12 years old. She leaves her parents and their love and goes into Alexandria, ruins her maidenhood, and then unrestrainably and insatiably gives herself up to sensuality. She works as a prostitute, but she doesn't even make much money off of it because she gives herself away for free so that more men will have her. So, and then she gets, so this is the state of her life. She is, you know, fairly clear that she wants to just gloss over this as quickly as possible. But of course, then she has to get to the point of what changed? How did it change? And so she, at one summer, she sees a large crowd and asks where the crowd is off to, and they are all going to Jerusalem for the feast of the exaltation of the precious and life-giving cross, which will take place in a few days. She says, will they take me? Well, if you have money, sure, of course, they'll take you on the boat. She says, I have no money, but nor do I have food, but I shall go with them and shall go aboard and they shall feed me, and whether they want to or not, I have a body. They shall take it instead of pay for the journey. And she was suddenly filled with a desire to go to have more lovers who could satisfy her passion. And then she tries to break off the story again. I told you, Abba Zazima, not to force me to tell you of my disgrace. God is my witness. I am afraid of defiling you and the very air with my words. And I love Abba Zazima's response. Speak on, for God's sake, mother, speak, and do not break the thread of such an edifying tale. It's like an edifying tale. It's about to get more or less R-rated. But this is also a part of the stories that we tell one another and that we engage with. Why is Maruska Sera telling her horror story about the mission hospital and her experience there? Well, part of it is to make sense of the experience. Part of it is also a cautionary tale, a tale of what our society is devolving into. Get her to tell you the story sometime. But another part of it is just a survival tale. Glory to God, she survived. Thank you for your prayers. But as Tolkien notes, oddly, you know, these times when everything's going right and everything's fine and wonderful, they don't make for very long stories. They're quickly told, and then it's done. The really great stories are stories of suffering, are stories of struggle, of stories of having to fight through some great difficulty and overcome it. We need to know that the ending is going to be happy. I think because we need that reassurance that we can win through in the end. And so she goes on and talks about how she got there. I'll gloss over that part. And got to the church in Jerusalem at the Feast of the Exaltation of the Cross. Well, then actually before that, she was just running around, finding more people to be with. But then at the Feast of the Exaltation of the Cross, she wants to go into the church with everybody else. And she tries to go into the church, and she can't. Like, what? What's going on? And she just figures, well, you know, I'm relatively small. I'm a woman, you know. It's just harder. I'll just have to like elbow my way through a little harder. And she can't. And she tries like again and again, and she just can't manage it. And finally she realizes the reason she can't get into the church is because God is keeping her out. And all of a sudden, at that moment, like obviously wasn't any time before this. Even her motive for going to this feast was the wrong motive. But now, all of a sudden, she realizes she's cut off from God. This life that she's lived, these things that were life to her, are actually death. She is as close to no longer being human as it's possible to become. And so, because she's overwhelmed, overcome, absolutely mastered by her lusts, her desires. And so she cannot enter. And so she is out there on the narthex. She looks up, sees an icon of the Mother of God. And she prays to the Mother of God, saying to her how well I know it is no honor or praise to you when one so impure or depraved as I look up to your icon, who keep, O ever virgin, who keeps kept your body and soul in purity. Rightly do I aspire in hatred and disgust before your virginal purity, but I have heard that God, who was born of you, became man on purpose to call sinners to repentance. Then help me, for I have no other help. Order the entrance of the church to be open to me. Allow me to see the venerable tree on which he who was born of you suffered in the flesh, on which he shed his holy blood for the redemption of sinners and for me, unworthy as I am. Be my faithful witness before your son that I will never again defile my body in the impurity of fornication. But as soon as I have seen the tree of the cross, I will renounce the world and its temptations and will go wherever you will lead me. And then she's able to go through. It was just as easily as, you know, walking into a church. She walks into the church and she venerates the Holy Cross, and then she gives thanks to the Mother of God, and she hears a voice from on high: if you cross the Jordan, you will find perfect rest. And so she does. She goes and is gets a bit of bread, and goes down to the Jordan River, and rinses her face and hands in its holy water, partakes of communion there, and then goes into the desert. And from that moment on, she is in the desert. And of course, Zosima is like, okay, well, that's an amazing story, but I want to know how this works. You know, what food did you have? Well, I had the 2.5 loaves that I got before I went to the desert, and then the rest of the time I've just been living on what's out here in the desert. How can it be that without getting ill, you have lived for so many years thus without suffering in any way from such a complete change? It's like, no, no, you remind me, Zosima, of what I dare not speak of, for I call all the dangers I overcame, the violent thoughts which confuse me. I'm afraid that they will take possession of me. Don't hide anything from me, says Zosima. And so she then goes on to talk about her struggle. Believe me, Abba, 17 years I passed in this desert, fighting wild beasts, mad desires, and passion. When I was about to partake of food, I used to begin to regret the meat and the fish which I had so much of in Egypt. I regretted not having the wine I loved so much, for I drank a lot of wine when I lived in the world, and here I had not even water. The mad desire for profligate songs also entered me and confused me greatly. But when such desires entered me, I struck myself on the breast and reminded myself of the vow I had made when going to the desert. My thoughts, I returned to the icon of the Mother of God who had received me, and to her I cried in prayer. I implored her to chase away the thoughts to which my miserable soul was succumbing, and after weeping for long and beating my breast, I used to see light at last, which seemed to shine on me from everywhere. So she has already said that she lived a life of passion for 17 years. And now, since Abba Zosima is asking, she reveals to him, it's not been easy. It's been incredibly difficult for 17 years. Every time I even went to eat some food, I was troubled with temptation, desire to go back, to leave this, to leave this life, because, you know, she's hungry, she's thirsty. And her mind is tormented with all the horrible songs she used to sing, and so there's this struggle that she goes through, and then and what preserves her in this? Her vow and her gratitude to the Theotokos and her prayers. And I said that we have. There's a reason for why we tell certain stories at certain times. There's a reason why this story is given to us at this time. We are in the midst of our most difficult ascetic labor, the labor of Great Lent. It is hard. It is difficult. We are hungry. We are thirsty. We would really like those forms of entertainment that perhaps we are denying ourselves. But what will strengthen us in this? What will enable us to continue in this struggle? Well, if we are going to be men and women of our word, if our word is going to be our bond, which is what we are aiming for, we are aiming to become true human beings again, then we need to hold fast to the discipline, the vow. We need to do so, moreover, in prayer, out of gratitude for the redemption that we have already had. More than that, this struggle of Great Lent that we're in, of ascetic labor that we're involved in right now, it's more than just, did you have a good fast? Did you manage not to eat any steaks during Great Lent? That's not what it's about. What is it about? It's about our struggle ultimately with sin, which is exactly the next thing that Mary talks about. What shall I begin to tell you about the thoughts which urge me on to fornication? How can I express them to you? A fire was kindled in my miserable heart, and as soon as this craving came to me, I flung myself on the earth and watered it with my tears, as if I saw before me my witness who appeared to me in my disobedience. And I did not rise from the crime until a calm and sweet, did not rise from the ground until a calm and sweet light descended and enlightened me and chased the thoughts that possessed me. But she says that sometimes she would lie on the ground for a day and a night, watering it with her tears until she is finally able to stand up. And this, I think, is our struggle with sin is precisely why this story is given to us right here, right now, in the depths of Great Lent. We need to know that we are not alone in this struggle. We need to know that it is a struggle, that it is something that is going to be all-consuming, that is going to take a long time. Mary of Egypt struggled with the sins that she and the lifestyle that she had embraced for 17 years in the desert for 17 years. She had the luxury of lying on the ground and watering it with her tears for a day and a night. We don't. I'm not saying that we have it easier than Mary of Egypt, but on some level we don't. We are involved in the world. If I lie down on the ground and water it with my tears for a day and a night, there will be things that don't get done. And people who come and say, wait, where's that thing you were supposed to have marked, Mr. Hewlett? And I will get in trouble. And yet I'm engaged in the same struggle that St. Mary of Egypt was engaged in. So how long can I expect to be struggling with this? No. If for her to turn from 17 years worth of a lifestyle to the level of perfection that she had attained when she encountered Elder Zosima, you know, if it had taken her 17 years plus to get there, I think I could probably expect to be struggling with this for the rest of my life. And that's okay. That's precisely what I need to do and what I need to be strengthened to do. And so it's not the end of the story, but to gloss through the rest of the story, I mean, this is the end of her story as she relates a child to Zosima, but of course it's in this frame story. And so the elder Zosima, she tells him to go and next year come back and bring her communion, because that's the one thing that she really wants. He comes back, brings her communion. She walks in the water to get it. And then she tells him, okay, well, come back next year. Meet me at the place where you first met me, and then when he comes back next year, she's dead. And in fact, he realizes that she died just after receiving communion, which was her final wish. And again, the ending is hugely important. In fact, at the end of this story, a lion comes, helps Elder Zosima bury the body of Mary of Egypt. And then he goes back to the monastery, eventually becomes the abbot of the monastery. Many things that are broken in the monastery get fixed. They all live happily ever after in the story. And that's the core of the story that we're engaged with. One of the beautiful things about the ending of Watership Down is that Hazel, who is the main leader of the story, gets old and dies. Because, you know, rabbits don't have very long lifespans. So they finally achieved what they set out to achieve. And then he gets old and he's slowing down. And as he's about to die, El Herrera, the prince of the rabbits, that one that they told all the stories about, the myth, shows up and says, you know, you look kind of old and tired. I have a solution for that. I really need another rabbit in my royal guard, my Ausla. Would you join me? And Hazel says, well, of course, Lord. And he leaves his body because he doesn't really need that anymore. And he goes off with the prince of the rabbits into the... And this is the beauty of this within the context of this story, where you've been hearing all these myths, all these stories. Now, all of a sudden, at the very end, we realize the myths, the stories were real. And that's the thing that we, as followers of Jesus Christ, as we're entering on this incredible, difficult life, life work of warfare, to simply become human again, to simply get back to what we were originally created to be, which is difficult and hard and dangerous, but doable, because we have the stories that reveal to us that it's doable. And more than that, the greatest myth of all, as one of C.S. Lewis's colleagues said to him, which was one of the eye-opening moments for him as an atheist. It's like, wrong thing, this myth about a dying God. It seems as if it actually happened once. And that's our experience. This myth, this story about the creator of the universe coming and becoming one of us and dying to save us, and coming and then bringing us into that reality, is one that we experience over and over and over again ourselves every Pascha. One that has been experienced over and over and over again by men and women down through the centuries. We know this to be true. And this true story, which is both the oldest story imaginable and the newest one, because it's being lived out. It's been lived out since the beginning, and it is being lived out right here, right now, by us. This story is what gives us the ability, the strength to persevere, to carry on in the struggle, to know that we can and will have victory by God's grace as we persevere in the struggle, and that as we continue in this struggle, persevering unto the end, that God is with us and Christ is in our midst.